the topic of cross-cultural ministry because as pastors we will necessarily be addressing this topic, hopefully to the benefit of the church and the blessing of souls that the Lord of the church bids us to serve. Indeed, Professor Schumacher will be addressing this with the title, All Things to All People, Cross-Cultural Dimensions of Pastoral Ministry. Professor Schumacher serves as our Mission Assistant Prof of Historical Theology and Assistant to the Director of Resident Field Education for Cross-Cultural Experiences. Before joining our faculty in 1998, he served as Evangelistic Missionary and Missionary Counselor of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod in Botswana, Africa. He's also served as part of the Mission Education Committee of the Missouri District and as an advisory delegate to the Synodical Convention for the Board for Mission Services in 1989. Would you welcome Professor Schumacher?
Well, thank you. It is a genuine pleasure and an honor, really, to be invited to speak today on the cross-cultural dimensions of pastoral ministry. As with most such honors, however, there is an inherent risk. In this case, the risk is that I will have nothing to say that most of you haven't already heard me say at other times. But if you're willing to take the risk of hearing it again, I'm willing to take the risk of saying it again. In the interest of full disclosure, I ought to say right up front that I have some cross-cultural background, but my first-hand experience in the kind of pastoral ministry that most of you will eventually be called to do is actually pretty thin. This is doubtless why the seminary does not have me teaching courses in practical theology. But in spite of this lack of hands-on experience in pastoral ministry in North America, I would like to do my best this morning to provide you with a little bit of information, some interpretation, and a few ideas about how all of this matters or should matter to you as you prepare for pastoral ministry. And I should emphasize that my focus today is really on the normal ministry of a parish pastor in the United States and what I believe to be the crucial cross-cultural dimensions of such ministry. The rather specialized ministry of overseas missionaries is obviously close to my heart, but I really won't say very much about the challenges and joys of such service. A few of you, maybe even more than a few of you, will one day be offered such challenges and share such joys, but if you want me to talk about foreign mission work, we'll have to schedule another time because my theme this morning really is on the ordinary parish ministry, whatever that is. It is also fair to warn you that hardly anything I have to say this morning is really my own idea. I borrow shamelessly and eclectically. That's fair to tell you because like a lot of people around here, use a lot of stuff that's not original to me. And as this little masterpiece by Scott Adams reminds us, even in the event that I did have a fabulous, original new idea, it would probably belong to the seminary anyway. Asok, who I guess is still an intern, although he's been an intern for a long time, has an epiphany in a meeting. Sweet mother of potatoes, I just thought of a $1 billion idea. The boss, the company owns all of your ideas, cough it up or we'll fire you and then sue you. And in comfort, Asok is told, your first $1 billion idea is always the hardest. Hopefully, if I have an original idea, it will be worth $1 billion. The seminary can use the money. I will divide my time today roughly in half between two simple questions. The first one, why? The second one, how? Under the why part, I intend to convince you that every pastor in 21st century America, and that includes you, or most of you, needs to develop the skills, attitudes, and desire to navigate among different cultures. When I get to the how part, I want to offer a few suggestions about what such ministry in cross-cultural dimensions may look like, and then what some of the implications of all this may be for pastoral practice. Only a few. It's not intended to be exhaustive. And my plan then is to allow some time at the end for your questions, comments, and discussion if anyone is still here and still awake. Okay then, why? Back in the late Bronze Age, when I was a seminary student here, sitting nervously in very much less comfortable seating in this very auditorium on call night, nobody around this place devoted very much attention to questions of cross-cultural ministry, except for those few of us who were going to need passports to reach the location of our first calls. I think it was more or less assumed that most of our ministries, most of the time, in most of the calling congregations would be among people a lot like us. And at the time, in the mid-1980s, that was probably a reasonable assumption. The Missouri Synod was then, and still is, by the way, a largely white, English-speaking church body, mostly people of Northern European background. I hope that it doesn't come as too much of a big shock to any of you that the country we live in today is in some ways quite a bit different than it was in 1985. I'm about to show you a few ways that we have changed as a people, and to do so, I'm going to throw some statistics at you, and I hope the pictures will soften the blow. Mostly graphs, really. You should know that even though I can balance my checkbook and read a budget, if necessary, numbers are not really my preferred mode of thinking. When confronted with a lot of statistics, I find my mind kind of wandering, and the more numbers you pelt me with, the less convinced I am of your argument. Far from being persuaded by the old saying that numbers can't lie, I tend to think in my gut that numbers can't really tell the truth. This is my problem, not yours, necessarily. Another part of my brain knows, of course, that numbers and quantitative data can actually be put to some limited use. And for all I know, all of you are closet engineers and accountants who just love to calculate standard deviations and margins of error just for the fun of it. In that case, you'll probably want to just go and get the raw data yourself from the U.S. government census website, and then you can doze off here for the next few minutes, even though it will hurt my feelings. The numbers I'm about to flog you with are not about a statistical analysis at all, really. They're intended to provoke a theological and missiological reflection on who we are as an American people, and to prompt us to think clearly about the future of the church in America in the 21st century. Are you thinking about that? The future of the church? You should think about the future, because you're going to live there the rest of your lives. 20 years ago, I was a student here sitting in some convocation or other. 20 years from now, who knows, I may be thinking about retirement so I can write all those books I wanted to write. But what will the church look like then? What will your ministry look like then? The details, of course, are always in God's hands, and that's a good thing. But from what we know now, we can get a pretty good idea about the basic shape of some of the things that are coming. I want to start by saying something about America, and then I'll say a few things about the church. The data I use comes from the United States Census Bureau, so it's not divinely inspired or infallible, but it is interesting. First of all, America is a racially diverse country. It's getting more diverse all the time, but race in America is not really what it used to be. For one thing, those who formed their ideas about race in America in the turmoil of the civil rights movement of the 1950s, 60s, and 70s are going to have to adjust their ideas and get used to the fact that race in America is no longer about black and white primarily. For one thing, Hispanics, not African Americans are now the largest minority group in the United States. The proportion of the population who identify themselves as Hispanic or Latino grew from 9% to 12.5% in the 1990s, totaling over 35 million people today, compared with 34.6 million blacks. Asians and other racial groups also grew faster as a percentage than blacks. White non-Hispanics, and that's most of us, for those of you who are not up on the census categories, white non-Hispanics, on the other hand, were the only racial group measured in the census which actually declined as a percentage of the population. In 1990, approximately 75.6% of the U.S. population fit into this category of folks like us. But by 2000, only 69.1% could be described this way. Here's the way the pie of the U.S. population looked in 1990. The big slice there, which is light blue, actually should be white, because that's the white non-Hispanic population. The purple is black, the light blue is Hispanic, and there are a few other slices as well. That's 1990. This is 2000. I'll flip back and forth there. 1990, 2000. Another way of saying is that the white slice of the American pie was reduced by 8.6% in just 10 years. The Census Bureau estimates that white non-Hispanics will drop below 50% nationally sometime in the middle of this century, at which point there will be no more racial majority by anybody in the United States. So by about the middle of this century, there won't be any racial majority. Not whites or anybody else. Actually, the state of California is already there, as those of you from California probably already know. These realities can be easy to ignore or forget if you live in a state like Missouri, which is, in fact, quite a bit less diverse than the nation as a whole. Here's the U.S. population in 2000 and the state of Missouri in the year 2000. Missouri is not a normal place, if normal means looking like America. Some of you think that Missouri is not a normal place for other reasons. Have anything to say about that? If you're from one of the other heavily Lutheran states like Indiana or Iowa, it may be even more of a surprise. There's Indiana. There's Iowa. On the other hand, if you come from a place like Texas or California, this business of racial diversity and all of its complex implications for society is already old news. Those states look like the nation as a whole will probably look before you men retire. You see, we don't live here in a normal place, if there is such a place anymore. I'm beginning to think that Orange County, California is a lot more normal than St. Louis County in terms of its profile, the makeup and mix of its peoples. Now, that's not a bad thing. It's okay to visit places and live for a while in places that are not normal. But you shouldn't form the impression that the place we live here in Clayton, in St. Louis County, is a normal place, because it's not. The end of racial majorities will be an important social milestone, but this shift is already making itself felt in hundreds of ways, politically, economically, socially. For people, especially for white people, but not only for them, who grew up in a nation with a clear and overwhelming white non-Hispanic majority, having a 60% or a 55% white majority instead of 75 or 80% will feel like a huge cultural shift. That kind of major change in the racial makeup of a society can make people feel kind of scared and threatened, which is something you need to be aware of as a pastor. When I first received my call, my first call as a missionary to Botswana, my grandmother, God rest her soul, a decent and proper lady from Mississippi, nodded with pride when she heard the news, and she said, "That's fine, William, that's just fine." And then she added, somewhat doubtfully, "But aren't there a lot of black people there?" She was right, as it turned out. There are a lot of black people there. In fact, the population of Botswana is much more homogeneous and racially less diverse than the population of America. So much so, in fact, that when my family moved back from Botswana in 1995, my children felt uncomfortable at first to have so many white people all over the place. You and I are about to move to a foreign country called the future. And there are a lot of people there who don't look like us. Some other historically white European countries are struggling with similar trends. I taught last summer in Germany, and on the train with my wife leaving Frankfurt one day, I nudged her and I said, "Look around the car we're in and imagine how you would feel if you were a German." We were the only white people in a full train car. From where we sat, we could hear four or five different languages being spoken, none of them German or English. And we could see people who appeared to be from sub-Saharan Africa, the Middle East, South and Southeast Asia. I think that new reality is scary and confusing to many Germans, and it's scary to many Americans too. Part of the church's task, part of your task, will be to help convince people that it will be okay. That the newly visible diversity in America is something that God can handle just fine. The statistics about race are somewhat related to numbers about age of our population in the various places we live. I just want to say a quick word about that. The white non-Hispanic population, that's most of us, is older on average than the non-white non-Anglo population, and rural areas are generally whiter than cities. I'll bring some of this home to our own state here, Missouri. In Missouri, 83.8% of the population, the whole population, are non-Hispanic whites, but 85.4, a larger majority of the voting age population, is white non-Hispanic. Blacks make up 11.2% of the population in Missouri, but only 10.2% of the voting age population. Non-white, non-Anglo populations are younger on average than white, non-Hispanic populations. Perhaps ironically, there is evidence to suggest that as racial diversity is becoming more obvious across America, it may also be mattering less in some ways. There was a feature article about this about 2 years ago in Newsweek. The cover story was, "Does Race Matter?" or "The Changing Face of Race in America," I think was the title of the feature. For one thing, the sheer complexity of the picture makes it hard to keep the old stereotypes. As the Newsweek article pointed out, there used to be 3 census categories for race. Now there are 30. Just the form is a lot more complicated. There are 11 Hispanic subsets. What's more, the 2000 census form, for the very first time in our history, allowed people to identify themselves with more than one racial group. You didn't have to pick just one. You could identify yourself as more than one racial group. Almost 7 million people, 2.4% of the population, did exactly that. This was the first time they had that option, so there's no way to compare that to previous years, but it is reasonable to expect that this portion of the population, who identify themselves in more than one racial category, will continue to grow, making it harder and harder to categorize people according to the old racial labels. None of this means that race will simply go away as a problem in American society, but it will certainly be much different and much more complex in the future than it has been in the past. The black poet Pat Parker wrote a poem called "For the White Person Who Wants to Be My Friend," in which she said, "The first thing you do is to forget that I'm black. Second, you must never forget that I'm black." That's part of the complexity of race as it becomes more obvious, but at the same time more ambiguous and more complex. Now, it has been my experience that for some reason, many good, solid confessional Lutherans get a kind of allergic reaction to all of this diversity talk. Maybe some of your stomachs are tightening up, and you can feel yourself starting to tune me out and write me off. Now, I used to attribute this reaction, as I usually do when people disagree with me, to those people being either stupid or evil, or maybe both. But I have begun to understand that some people hear what I'm saying as just an echo of the current fad of multiculturalism. The multiculti craze is simply a pop culture buzzword that claims to celebrate any and every difference simply for the sake of difference, and yet it never really takes any of those differences very seriously. Dyed-in-the-wool multiculturalists often pretend to stand in some mythical position above or outside of cultures, selecting and savoring the differences like a glutton at an international buffet. According to this fad, just about any group with anything in common can claim to be their own culture and then start to use that to legitimize whatever weird or marginal behavior they're pushing. Everybody wants to play the game. So Gen X tattooed bikers demand their civil rights. 40-something single vegans lobby for special entitlements. Really hip churches start ministries to movie addicts. I got a taste of that kind of multiculturalism soon after I started working with Professor Utek on the cross-cultural field education program. It seems that several people in the St. Louis area were offering an all-day workshop on multicultural field education. Professor Utek handed me the brochure, and it seemed like the sort of thing we were going to do, and I decided to go, since I thought that that's what we were trying to do at Concordia Seminary, right? Well, it didn't take me very long to figure out that when most of them talked about cross-cultural ministry, they meant supporting and affirming gays and lesbians. I was in the wrong meeting. That kind of stuff gives me an allergic reaction, too. But that kind of trendy, faddish multiculturalism is not what I'm talking about at all. I'm really only trying to make two points, one merely descriptive and the other passionately biblical. One, the country we live in and in which you will serve God's people is an increasingly diverse place in terms of language, race, and ethnic background. Sociologists are talking about America as a patchwork quilt rather than a melting pot, and they may be right. Even sociologists are right once in a while. And two, God wants all those wildly diverse people, folks who don't talk like us or look like us or eat like us or dress or smell or live like us, He wants all of them to know the forgiveness, life, and salvation He has bought for them with the death of His only Son, Jesus Christ. You and I know that because somebody told us, not because we're so smart and naturally gifted and good-looking. So how are all those non-white, non-Anglo-Americans going to know about that same gospel unless somebody tells them? Somebody maybe like you. I'm not interested in cross-cultural ministry because all of those differences are so nifty and exotic. I'm passionate about crossing cultural boundaries with the gospel of Jesus Christ because they might be lost if you and I wait for them to enter our comfort zone and become like us. Like the Apostle Paul, I look around me and see all these different kinds of people, and I commit to trying to become all things to all people so that by all possible means I might save some. Okay, that's part one. Those of you who dozed off during the statistical part should wake up now, because I want to talk about the how. It's time to turn our attention to the how of cross-cultural pastoral ministry. What inferences are we to draw for the mission of the church from the changing face of race in America? For starters, the Missouri Synod is faced again today, as we were in the early 20th century, with a profound choice about whether we should remain isolated within one ethnic group or whether our confessional Lutheran identity as a church body can survive the process of coming to look more and more like the America we inhabit. For an earlier generation, it was the wrenching shift from German to English. For us and our children, that choice will probably be the challenge of becoming a genuinely multiracial and multilingual church body, in which it is no longer realistic to imagine one majority group dominating church life. How many non-white or Hispanic seminary students do we have today? How many non-white or Hispanic district presidents? What about our seminary and university faculties? It is deeply troubling, I must tell you, that we have such difficulty attracting non-white, non-Anglo students to study for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Seminary, and then we have trouble keeping them once we recruit them. If we don't figure out how to do a better job of this, then we as a church body are going to be very ill prepared for ministry in what is rapidly becoming normal American society. There is a real and urgent need for the LCMS to work in an intentional and a sustained way to plant churches among the parts of the U.S. population that are growing the fastest. And that doesn't mean folks like us. That means non-white, non-Anglo communities. We've made a beginning at this work, but I fear that it is still viewed mostly as a sideline, not really our core business, as it were. We just aren't very good at that kind of ministry yet, and I believe that it's because deep down, we haven't made up our minds collectively that it's really and truly Lutheran to reach people who aren't like us. A study last year by the Graduate Center of the City University of New York found that Lutherans, ranked at the top of the list for once, Lutherans, collectively at least, are the whitest religious group in America. 96% of Lutherans are white, non-Hispanic. That makes us whiter than Presbyterians, whiter than Mormons, and way whiter than Episcopalians, whom people used to describe as the Republican Party at prayer. Crossing the lines of race, language, and culture in the U.S. will need to become more a part of normal church life in the LCMS if we want to effectively confess the gospel in American society as it already is today, to say nothing of how America will look tomorrow and by the middle of the century. Of course, it's not just a question of recruiting ethnics to minister to ethnics or of planting congregations that are deliberately or even artificially homogeneous. If that were the only way the church coped with diversity, then none of you would really have to worry about it. It would be their problem for them to solve. Whites would take care of white churches, blacks would take care of black churches, Hispanics would handle Hispanic churches, and so forth. Obviously, some of that happens and will continue to happen, but there is also a need to build congregations that are places where unity, the unity of the people of God, becomes visible in a particular place, a unity that transcends and trumps the divisions that separate people, including the divisions of race and language and culture. So we need to be in the business of creating and nurturing multiracial, multi-ethnic congregations, not under the flag of some trendy multiculturalism, but because God wants those people reached. There are places like that around if you want to see them. West Portal Lutheran Church in San Francisco is a place like that, I think. They have an interesting combination there. They have almost no parking. So there's one church growth principle out the window. But they seem to pack in an amazing number of a dizzying variety of skin colors, accents, and styles of dress, running the range from Gucci to Goodwill. That stuff doesn't seem to matter to the people at West Portal as they gather around the message of the forgiveness of sins and life in Christ. Trinity Lutheran Church in Des Moines is a place like that. You can't get much deeper in the heartland of Lutheranism than Des Moines. Remember the diversity pie I showed you a few minutes ago? Iowa is near the bottom of the list in diversity. Even Missouri is more diverse than Iowa. And yet, Trinity Lutheran Church in Des Moines has found a way to reach some of those other slices. There are a lot of people at Trinity who look a lot like most of us in this room, but Trinity has three services on a Sunday morning, one in English, one in the Nuer language of Southern Sudan, and one in Lao, which isn't hard to understand if you know Thai. I'm told. West Portal in San Francisco and Trinity in Des Moines are very different places. But in both those places and lots of others besides, people who have little else in common are called, gathered, enlightened, sanctified, and kept in the true faith as the Holy Spirit works in the church through the gospel of Jesus Christ. My friends, that kind of church usually doesn't happen by accident. First and foremost, God the Holy Spirit does that on purpose because he wants all those different people to come to Christ and believe in him. And since God is doing this on purpose, he uses people to carry that out. Congregations that are effective in crossing cultural boundaries need competent, courageous pastoral leadership. Now I'm talking about you guys. Differences can be scary. People don't like having their status quo messed with. They will need a pastor who will help them see that not only is it okay, but it's something God really wants to see done among them. Now, sometimes this means facing resistance. A pastor I know was called to a small congregation only a few miles from a large Indian reservation. Soon after he arrived, he was meeting with his elders, and he brought up the question of whether there would be any objection to him going to the reservation and doing evangelism visits there. And the elders listened, and the head elder said, "Yeah, pastor, that'll be fine. Go up there and do all the evangelism you want. Just don't invite any of them to church." The pastor at Trinity in Des Moines told me that some members left the congregation because of all the foreign people who were coming in. And he said that the worship wars of having Africans and Asians and Germanic Iowans in church together was nothing compared to the kitchen wars that arose between the ladies who wanted to use the church kitchen to cook their meals. Because cultural boundaries are also often language boundaries, pastors and congregations will often need to figure out how to negotiate around basic communication problems. Sometimes that means learning another language, one that actual living people speak. at least learning enough so that you can greet people politely and ask how their children are. You'd be amazed how flattered people are when they hear you trying to speak their own language. Sometimes the most effective and helpful method is rather to help others learn your language. Many churches have been discovering how English as a second language, or ESL classes, offer a natural connection to non-white, non-Anglo, non-English-speaking communities that are all around them. Still another way to manage the language problem is to rely on interpreters. This can be as simple as finding anyone, even a child, who is capable in both languages and can help sort out the basics of communication so that you know whether they're looking for the bathroom or for the soup kitchen. But the role of an interpreter can go much, much deeper than that. Some pastors who are working in cross-cultural ministry rely heavily on a mature leader from within that other community who not only carries messages back and forth between two languages, but serves as a kind of window to help explain two different worlds to each other. When you grow that kind of mature interpreter, that kind of bridge person between two languages and two cultures, you're also getting into the business of developing Christian leaders from within the other group. At some point, some of those leaders may become pastors themselves, and I want you to file something away for future reference, which you probably don't need to know about right now, but which may become important. At some point, the new seminary programs of distance education leading to ordination, DELTO, and the Ethnic Immigrant Institute of Theology might become resources for you as you help churches prepare new leaders that they need. People from groups that don't talk like us, don't look like us. As I say, you don't need to remember all of the details about the programs right now, but you should be aware that they exist. You should keep them in mind, because it's very likely, that each of you will get to know someone who may want and need to enroll in such a program. I'm not going to predict what every one of those congregations, every one of those cross-cultural pastoral ministries will look like. There is no single right way to get this done, and nor am I going to announce some grand strategy for doing cross-cultural ministry. What I urge you to do is to look for tactical solutions that adapt to the changing situations you find yourselves in, and be ready to try new things. In fact, ready to try all kinds of things so that by all means you may save some. Sometimes we cross cultural boundaries and reach the lost who are not like us by giving birth to new congregations among people who are not likely to be drawn to existing churches. Some of you will help do that. Some of you will help start brand new churches that are designed from the ground up to reach people who aren't being reached by existing Missouri Synod congregations. Sometimes an existing church grows a new ministry as a branch or extension of what they're already doing, and they cross into new cultural ground that way. Some of you can help churches do that. You can be a leader who helps churches catch a vision for that kind of branching out into an area of ministry that they haven't engaged in before. And sometimes congregations need their pastor to lead them to become bridges that connect very different people in one new community gathered by the gospel. I don't know how many of you remember watching the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind. In that movie, the image of, what is it, Devil's Tower in Wyoming, this unique rock formation, keeps coming back, and that is eventually, of course, the I don't want to spoil the movie for those of you who haven't seen it. That is eventually the scene of the climax of the movie. But before you actually get there, various characters in the film, including the Richard Dreyfuss character, find themselves just sort of compulsively constructing piles of stuff, whatever happens to be handy, whether it's mashed potatoes or dirty clothes or toys and Legos, constructing piles of stuff that kind of looks like that place they're going to go. And they don't know why. It's a place they haven't really been to before that they can remember, but they know what it looks like, kind of, and they keep trying to make something that looks like that. That's sort of what cross-cultural ministry is like. We're all trying to construct something that looks like a place we haven't been, which is described in the book of Revelation. A place where people of all nations and tribes and languages and tongues come together. And the stuff we make, the congregations we help lead and build, aren't exactly like that, but they're kind of like that. And we find ourselves building them again and again on a pattern of something we still look forward to. One of our recent graduates found himself in a place like that, and you might too. Here's what he writes. When I came here, we had about 30 people worshiping with us. The core group was made up of all white people. We discovered that 30% of the community was African American, Liberian. I rented a U-Haul truck and helped them move into their house. Today, about 50% of our worshipers are African Americans and Liberians. We've set up a food pantry. We now have someone who's willing to donate a new van to our church, for many of the Liberians need rides to church. We've helped the Liberians find jobs and places to live. We have enabled the Liberians to feel at home within our congregation. We've established a Liberian choir. Christ died for all. Therefore, we all live for him. He's commanded us to make disciples from all nations. There's nothing scientific about it. We just do it. Why? Because Christ's love compels us. What drives that kind of ministry isn't programs and strategies and big budgets and perfected methods, but a passion for the lost, and a willingness to go where they are to reach them with the gospel of Christ. It's a vision of what the church can look like, what the church will look like, that mirrors and models the scene in Revelation 7. After this I looked, and there was before me a great multitude that no one could count, from every nation, tribe, people, and language, standing before the throne and in front of the Lamb. They were wearing white robes and were holding palm branches in their hands, and they cried out with a loud voice, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." That, my friends, is a very compelling vision. A picture like that, firmly planted in your heads, will help you tough it out through worship wars and kitchen wars. It will help you navigate the strange terrain of language barriers and local leadership development. Why go through all that stuff, after all, when it's simpler just to stick with people like you? Simply because God sees those other people and loves them and wants to call them home to himself in the gospel. If he wants that, we want that too, right? It's the difference between seeing all those people who aren't like us and letting those people remain invisible to us and to our churches. Nothing is sadder to me than to visit one of our big old city churches, and we have a lot of them in the Missouri Synod, and hearing people talk about the glory days and how this was once a vibrant, thriving congregation, but they say, as everybody moved away, the school closed and the bowling alley was boarded up, and now they're having trouble paying the heat and keeping the lights on. Everybody moved away, they say. But as you walk out the door and look up and down the street, there are people all over the place. What those churches mean is that everybody like us moved away. And those other people out there on the street are somehow invisible to us as a church? Well, they're not invisible to God. He's planning to have a whole lot of them with him in heaven. And he wants us to help. Pastors who catch that vision, to see people who are not like themselves and who are driven by that passion to reach the lost, can and do